Just to trace through the bit of the story to bring it back to your mind, we've looked at the conflict at the last moment when they judged him, but you go right back to chapter 1 in Mark and trace through that first section from chapter 1 through to chapter 2 and then the first few verses of chapter 3, and I'll remind you of some of the scenes. You remember the leper scene? That's the first one recorded in the Synoptic Gospels, where Jesus does something quite beautiful, quite attractive, quite lovely, but he gets into trouble. Because while anyone not knowing the Torah, not knowing the various fences that have been erected, would think, wasn't that wonderful what Jesus did? Those who knew the Torah knew Leviticus chapter 23 and knew that God had said, as they understood it, that a leper could not be touched. He was untouchable, and that if you touched a leper, you incurred the punishment of the law. You, in fact, were going against the will of God. Now, that fence was to protect something. It was presumably to protect, well, health, I suppose, but also purity of religion and whatever else it may have been meant to protect. But something in what Jesus was doing was seen to go break through the fence and therefore judged to be wrong, just because it broke through the fence. Remember the next scene, straight after that, is the paralyzed man comes to Jesus, dropped down through the roof, and Jesus heals him, but heals him right inside, deep paralysis. Your sins are forgiven. He says something about the man's relationship with life and God, much more than his what was happening in the physical side of it. And you recall, again, the upkeepers of the law were shocked. More than that, they said he blasphemed. Because for them, oh yes, you could have various little sacrifices down in the temple for outward sins in case you inadvertently did something you didn't notice. So just to keep a two-bob each way, you could go down there and offer some pigeons or a bit of a sheep or something, and the priest would offer it up to God, and then somehow those external things you might have tripped on a fence without noticing, it'd all be fixed up somewhere. But sin, that is deep personal sin, couldn't be forgiven by such things, and they never imagined it could be forgiven at all, except by God, and that was up to God, sin. And here was Jesus declaring that sins were forgiven, forgivable. He was daring to say that there's a place for human relationship which goes even into this very sacred area, and they accused him of blasphemy for that. And the very next scene, just if I remind you, Jesus goes and eats with sinners, doesn't he? Tax collectors and sinners. That seems a great thing to us from a distance. But if you're there on the spot, no religious group allowed it. It was totally unacceptable to mix with people who didn't come to church on Sunday, the equivalent. You didn't mix with such people, lest you be contaminated by their sinfulness. If you play with fire, you get burnt. So you didn't eat, you certainly didn't have a sacred encounter like a meal with excommunicated, non-participating people in the synagogue worship. Jesus did it. And you know what he said. Where would you expect a doctor to be among the sick? Where would you expect God's love to be except where it's needed here? They couldn't see that, and the law didn't allow it, which meant God didn't want it. That was their definition of it. And I better not go to too many more, I'll just take two more and then read you a small text just to remind you of this conflict is what I'm trying to get at. And I'm pushing it because the conflict is in my life and in yours as well. It's a very relevant conflict we're looking at. How do you discern the will of God is kind of the deep question we're attempting to look at. And it was a real problem in Jesus' day and no less a problem today. The next scene was a fast day, you remember. And everybody was fasting. Why? Because the Torah said to fast. Simple. God's will declared in the law said it was a fast day. Everyone's fasting except Jesus and his disciples. Why weren't they fasting? And they came up to him and said, why aren't you fasting? He talked about bridegrooms and he talked about love banquets and he went off into this incredible, beautiful, mystical thing, but it didn't seem at all relevant to them. And then, lo and behold, the next Sabbath, he seems totally unrepentant, mind you. The very next Sabbath, the text says, he happened to be going for a walk on the Sabbath through the cornfields. You know, he happened to be doing it. No one ever did it, but he happened to be doing it. Like, and it weren't allowed to do it, and there were fences that said you couldn't do that because the Sabbath had to be kept sacred. And, well, the next bit I'll read to you, because it brings the point, and this is the last thing I'll say on this, but it's chapter 3, verse 1, a scene that you can't afford to forget in this line, when it says, Jesus went again into the synagogue. He's making a point here. And there was a man there who had a withered hand. And they, and by now I hope you know who they are, they is us. You know, it's people who are wrapped up in the Torah and trying to do God's will by it. Ordinary people, shocked by Jesus. They were watching him to see if he'd cure him on the Sabbath day, hoping for something to use against him. And Jesus said to the man with the withered hand, whom everyone seems to have forgotten except Jesus, stand up out in the middle. And then Jesus said to them, is it against the Torah, the law? Is it against the law on the Sabbath day to do good or to do evil? To save life or to kill? But they said nothing. The question was the wrong question for them. Didn't compute. What's it got to do with life, death, good and evil? It's the law. They don't understand it. It came from God. You can find the text if you want to look it up. It's all very clear. You're not allowed to do it because God said you couldn't do it. Period. That's it. And Jesus is asking all these other big questions. And they don't know where they're going, so they didn't say anything. Then, grieved to find them so obstinate, he looked angrily round at them and said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was better. And the Pharisees went out and at once began to plot with the Herodians, discussing how to destroy him. So, something you follow me, I'm sure. There's a key problem here. So-called religious people, ordinary people, given this magnificent gift from God, which has been protected by scholars and experts and so-called religious authorities for centuries, and it's a great gift, and it ensures them against the insecurity of getting lost, and warning devices lest they leave the way, and they're walking along the way of God. And Jesus comes in, and there's hardly a fence left. At least this fence is falling round all over the place, and they're just getting all terribly confused. Because he seems to be a nice person, he seems to be all these things, but he is breaking the laws. What's happening? Why do they understand the Torah so differently? Let's just hold that question for a minute, and I'll now come at from a different angle. So is the question clear? Right. Now, I'm going to present you, before the break now, with two models, two ways of looking at the Torah. One of them, you'll soon gather, doesn't appeal to me over much, because I don't think it's right. That's another matter. The other one does appeal to me, and I do think that what I'm trying to present to you is the two models of the Pharisee and of Jesus, as best I can, to see the way they looked at law. Now, before doing that, I need to talk to you about four critical points, four definitions of terms that the Pharisees and Jesus would have all had in common in a way, but they would have looked at them differently. And they're most important concepts, so let me take you through them slowly. I'm going to look at the immanence of God, the transcendence of God, what we mean by revelation, and what we mean by inspiration. Big, big stuff this all is. But it is the context within which only, I think, we can really look at the models and see what they're all about. Let's begin with the immanence of God, because Jesus believed that, so did the Pharisees. What do we mean when we say that God is immanent? Remaining within, the word means, immanence of God. It's a simple concept in itself. It's saying that somehow the mystery, the sacred one, God, is not totally other than the world. That somehow, at the heart of the world, we find the sacred presence. That God is at the heart of a husband, a wife, a child. That God is at the heart of the wind. And that if I listen to the wind, I can learn something about the one who is present in the wind. God is there at that Bethel rock that Jacob sleeps on, this sacred place, this awe-inspiring place. God is in the assembly of the people. God is in the stars of the heavens, that the glory of God fills the whole earth. As whatever that psalm is, if I go to the ends of the earth, I find you there. If I go to the highest mountain, there you are. If I go into the depths of the sea, says the psalmist, I find you there. It's something touching on the presence, I guess is the best word I can think of, the presence of God in the events and history and movements of our daily life. And so, in a way, obviously, whatever happened to Moses, God was at the heart of it. God was present in that encounter. God is somewhere found in the Torah, in those laws and enactments and so on. God is present mysteriously in this world. A lovely text that I found not so long ago, when I looked back again at St. Augustine's Confessions, which is jumping a little bit from here, but I thought I'd just give it to you because it expresses it rather beautifully. It's in his autobiography, chapter 10, book 10, chapter 6, paragraph 9, where he says, I asked the earth, he's seeking God, eh? I asked the earth, I asked the sea, and they replied, we are not your God, look beyond us. And I asked the sky, and the sun, and the moon, and the stars, and they said, neither are we the God whom you seek. And I said to all these things, you've told me concerning my God that you are not he. Tell me something about him. And with a loud voice they cried out, he made us. My questioning was my looking upon them. And their reply was their beauty. A parent might be absent, but if the child is present to you, to your vision, then the child is a statement of the presence of the parent. The child only makes sense, is the gift of the parents. The world, when we talk about the immanence of God, we are talking about that dimension of reality perceived in religious experience, which demands a cry, he made us. But in that text of Augustine, we move on, obviously they're too interconnected, to what we mean by the transcendence of God. Because while it's true that God is at the heart of everything, the Jewish faith believed, and it's, I think, philosophically the only acceptable position, that God is not part of the universe, not even the major part. God isn't the soul of the universe, or a particular dimension of the universe. God is totally other, though immanent. He is not us. God is not the sky. God is not the wind and the stars. God is God, transcendent God, though everything else participates in the being of God. I'll take it that those two concepts are clear enough. If you want to question on them later, let's do that. But just for the moment, the immanence and transcendence, the presence and yet the total otherness of the one present. You'll see how these become important in a moment. Now let's move to the concept of revelation. Revelation, the word means removing the veil. Revelation happens whenever anyone encountering something in human experience recognizes that there's more to the experience than what can be explained by the empirical sciences or by the senses that we have. That somehow there recognizes the immanence of God. That a person who experiences his or her life and then one day experiences his or her life as gift. Now, gift is something more than who I am, but as gift. A person who experiences what St. Ignatius of Loyola will call a consolation without cause. A person who experiences being loved. And not just by husband, wife, friend, teacher, but being loved. And the lover is the mystery. Whenever we are caught into any experience and are touched by the immanent God, then that experience, a religious experience, as we've discussed it in earlier lectures, that gathers together our whole being in that moment and that silence and that presence, in that religious experience, a veil falls away and a disclosure happens. Something of God, a mystery, of course, still, but something of the immanence of God touches us. The scales fall from our eyes ever so little, or ever so greatly, but we are in contact with the mystery, the presence. That's revelation happening. And of course it happens to every little baby, it happens to every little child, it happens to every human being. Though there are some people, revelation often happens, I mean we can reveal things to each other. You can be having an experience and someone else will find the words for you. And then you'll see what you've seen. You're actually looking at it, but someone shows you what you look at, and then you see, yes, that's what I'm seeing. And that person reveals it to you. Some people have a peculiar gift, I suppose, and this varies all the way through to a person like Moses, who sees something in religious experience and finds words for it, which a whole nation can say to that person, that prophet, yes, that's it. You've said what I've experienced. They recognize in the prophet, and that's how prophecy is recognized, that's what prophecy is, finding the words, finding the revelation, finding the law, the Torah, somehow a public act almost, that one, and that's why they are where they are, because a person says something and all of the rest of us say yes to it. Recognizing in that person's statement. Do you remember Jesus? He taught with authority, not like their own scribes. Because when he spoke, people grew and recognized there something of their own religious experience. So that's, I think, what revelation is in the ordinary human experiences of our life, personal and then communal. Finally, as an introductory concept, the concept of inspiration. Inspiration, like revelation, is a very simple concept, essentially. Inspiration means breath, the breath of God breathing through everything. In a way, everything is inspired. I mean, if a bird sings in the evening, then where does the breath come from but God, in whose life that bird participates in its own way. The beauty that we all saw, the clouds of heaven carrying the word of God, was a corrective sight of the Jewish Psalms. Everything is inspired. Adam was inspired when God breathed into him the breath of life. And whenever we act from God's life, whenever our words, our actions, our communication, whenever our breathing draws on the breath of God, then that's inspiration. And the artists that touch truth are clearly inspired. Beethoven is inspired in a very... Shakespeare is inspired, not all the time, I presume, but you know, whenever in touch with truth, in touch with reality, in touch with God, responding to the revelation of God, what comes out of that by way of human creative activity is rightly called inspired. But once again, while that's true, and I think if that isn't true, nothing's true, in that overall truth we all discern some people have a peculiar inspiration. Joshua was no doubt inspired and at times quite insightful in his responses to his religious experience. But Moses was inspired in a way that had an overall powerful influence on people's lives, and they sensed, mums and dads and uncles and aunties and grandparents and kids, something of God in the words of the man Moses. His words were inspired, particularly Jesus' words were inspired. The prophets spoke words. Everyone does. But they did it in a way in which the whole community recognized the relevance of their words to public life, public order, and so on.